It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll look at what's next for the Secret Service after a week of turmoil and staff turnover at the top.
First, when the Supreme Court of the United States reconvenes in 4 days on October 6th, it'll face a slate of contentious cases from freedom of speech and affirmative action to the Affordable Care Act and abortion rights.
Our next guest says, throughout U.S. history, the Supreme Court has often failed us. He looks at the court's record on slavery and protection for minorities, how it upheld the Constitution in times of crisis, its stance on big business, its widespread influence on the political process, and concludes that major reform is needed to fulfill its original intended role.
Erwin Chemerinsky joins us now. He's founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. His new book is The Case Against the Supreme Court. Erwin, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, you kick things off by saying if we're going to measure the Supreme Court's performance, we have to figure out what it was designed to do. Here's a quote. You say the primary reason for having a Supreme Court is to enforce the Constitution against the will of the majority. Can you expand on that?
Sure. The reality is the majority doesn't need a Constitution to protect itself. It can do so through the majoritarian process. What makes the Constitution different from all other laws is that it's so difficult to change the Constitution. Why would a democracy that believes in majority rule want to be governed under a constitution that's difficult to change? I think that's because we want to put our most precious values in a document that's difficult to change. I think that's the way in which we protect minorities of all sorts. It's also the way we make sure that in times of crisis, we don't cause our short-term passions to lose sight of our long-term commitments.
And that's where you say it often falls down. We haven't protected minorities. We haven't kept cool heads about the Constitution in times of crisis. I want to start with one case that ties both of those themes together, internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Can you talk us through the Supreme Court's role there?
Of course. During World War II, 110,000 Japanese Americans, aliens and citizens, and 70,000 were citizens, were uprooted from their lifelong homes and placed in what President Franklin Roosevelt called concentration camps. Not one Japanese American was ever accused, indicted, or convicted of espionage or any crime against national security. Race alone determined who would be imprisoned behind barbed wire and housed in horse stalls and who would be free. One would have hoped that the Supreme Court in 1944 would have said, this violates equal protection of the Constitution. It's race discrimination, pure and simple. But instead, the Supreme Court in Korematsu versus the United States ruled in favor of the federal government and upheld the evacuation of Japanese Americans.
And I want to tease apart those two themes. One, this was during wartime, and that was given as a reason for the initial internment there and as part of the justification, as I understand it, for the court backing up the president on that. Is this something we've done repeatedly through history, take a crisis situation and bend, at the Supreme Court level, bend the constitutional rules more, in your view, than we should have?
That's exactly what's happened. There are countries in the world that have clauses in their constitution that allow them to be suspended during wartime. To me, that's the exact opposite of what a constitution should be. The constitution to make sure that in wartime or other crises, we don't lose sight of those values. During World War I, individuals were convicted and imprisoned for speech that just criticized the draft and the war effort. There was no showing that their speech in any way hindered military recruitment or the war. During the McCarthy era, individuals were put in prison just for teaching works of Marx and Lenin and Engels. And now during the War on Terror, just a few years ago, there was a Supreme Court case that said that people could be convicted of materially aiding foreign terrorist organizations just for telling foreign groups how to apply for humanitarian assistance or how to use the United Nations to peacefully resolve their disputes.
And then the issue of protecting minorities, ethnic, racial, or otherwise, in the internment case, it was Japanese Americans. Again, is this a theme we see again and again through history?
It is. I think one of the most important things by which the court should be evaluated is how it's done with regard to race discrimination. A long time ago, in the early 19th century, Alexis de Tocqueville, in his book Democracy in America, said that race is the fatal flaw upon which American democracy was based. For the first 78 years of American history, from 1787 until 1865 when the 13th Amendment was passed, the Supreme Court aggressively enforced the rights of slave owners and protected the institution of slavery. For 58 years, from 1896 to 1954, it was the Supreme Court that said that separate but equal is constitutional. That's a lot of American history, and I think that everybody, liberals and conservatives, would say that the Supreme Court dismally failed during that time.
And current events caught up after, I think, your book went to press with the events in Ferguson, Missouri. In a recent op-ed in the New York Times, you say the Supreme Court has failed us when it comes to holding police departments, individual police, accountable in the United States. How so?
Well, in fact, there is a chapter in the book, though it was written before the events in Ferguson, that talk about how the Supreme Court has made it very difficult for those who are injured by the government, like police officers, to be able to get relief. There was a case in Los Angeles, now 30 years ago, where an individual was stopped for having a burnt-out taillight, and a police officer administered a chokehold on him. The individual, Adolph Lyons, did some research and learned at that point 16 people in Los Angeles had died from police use of the chokehold, almost all, like him, African-American men. He sued for an injunction to stop police from being able to use the chokehold unless it was necessary to protect the officer's life or safety. The Supreme Court ruled against Lyons and said he couldn't get an injunction because he couldn't show that he'd personally be choked again in the future. In fact, in other cases, the Supreme Court has made it very difficult to sue police officers. For instance, a police officer who commits perjury on the witness stand cannot be civilly sued for money damages.
So you are bringing up historical point after historical point from the dawn of the country to now. So it sounds like you're not saying there's a flaw with individual justices or personalities along the way. Is there something you see as being structurally wrong with the Supreme Court that raises these issues again and again?
There is. In the last full chapter of the book, I propose many reforms. And taken cumulatively, I hope that they will make a difference in the future. So, to give one example, I propose term limits for Supreme Court justices. I suggest 18-year non-renewable terms. I suggest change the way we confirm justices. I suggest we go to a merit selection system for justices. I also suggest that justices should have to follow the same ethics rules that lower federal court judges are bound by to change how recusal, disqualification, is done. I urge many changes in how the court communicates with the American people, including having cameras in every Supreme Court proceeding.
There's an image of the Supreme Court. Maybe this image has been battered in recent years. I don't know. These are the best and brightest in the legal profession. They're a neutral arbiter of laws, and you contest that in your book.
In terms of the best and the brightest, some are through history, and some aren't. No one would question that John Roberts or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, to pick somebody from the right and the left, are eminently qualified and brilliant individuals. But there are some who served on the Supreme Court over the course of history were picked for cronyism. They were friends of the president. They had very undistinguished careers on the Supreme Court. In terms of the Supreme Court being a neutral arbiter, I'm not even sure what that means. The Supreme Court has to make choices. Let's focus on what some of them are. Does the government have a compelling interest in having diversity in the classroom? Does a state have a sufficiently important interest in keeping same-sex couples from marrying? Should the police be able to pull over a car based just on an anonymous tip? I don't know how to be a neutral arbiter of any of those questions. The justices are making value judgments. All too often, the value judgments have been direct government power rather than individual freedom, direct businesses rather than consumers or employees.
Questions like the ones you just asked are typically ones that prospective justices decline to answer when they're going through confirmation before the Senate. Do we need to change that? How would we change that?
I think we do need to change it. I think the confirmation process has become what then-Senator Joe Biden referred to as an exercise in kabuki theater, especially if the Senate is the same political party as the president. The minority senators try to ask questions to trip up the nominee. The nominees are too smart for that. They don't answer any questions that might be controversial. They say things like, judges are just umpires, or judges apply the law, they don't make the law, and they get confirmed. I think the Senate should agree that whoever the nominee is, whatever political party, there are certain questions they're going to require the nominee to answer, and if the nominee refuses, the Senate won't confirm the individual. And every president through history has considered the ideology of the nominee as a factor in picking the person. The Senate consider ideology in deciding whether to confirm the person.
We're talking with Erwin Chemerinsky. He says the U.S. Supreme Court needs a major overhaul to fulfill its original mandate.
And we'd love for you to join the conversation. How do you rate the Supreme Court's performance? How do its decisions affect you and your community, maybe the American way of life? Do you believe the court needs an overhaul? If so, what needs to change? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court reviewing its performance over the past 200 years. We're talking with Erwin Chemerinsky, founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law. His new book is The Case Against the Supreme Court.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts or your questions for Professor Chemerinsky. How do you see the Supreme Court's decisions affecting ordinary Americans? Do you think the court is still fulfilling its original mandate? Our guest says it's to protect the Constitution against a sort of tyranny of the majority, to protect minorities from the majority. If not, what needs to change and how? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send a tweet at Central Time WPR. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Floyd on the line in Milwaukee. Floyd, hi.
Hi. My comment is one of the lowest points for the Supreme Court was the 2000 election when they gave it to Bush instead of Gore, instead of letting Florida handle it themselves, which they normally would have done. They had no business being involved in it whatsoever. And it was strictly along party lines. And if that didn't show their bias, I don't think anything else will.
Floyd, thanks a lot for that call. Erwin, are there lessons we can draw from that decision?
Well, in fact, in one of the chapters of the book, I talk about Bush versus Gore in detail, and I make exactly the same point that Floyd did, that this was a question of Florida state law. The law is clearly established that state courts are to get the last word of state law, but the Supreme Court took it over and decided. So is there a lesson? I think it goes to the question that you asked me before the break. Are the justices neutral umpires? Of course not. In that instance, the five justices who were appointed by Republican presidents, the most conservative on the court, made sure that George W. Bush was going to be the president.
And I think you use that as an example of the need for better communication from the court to the public as something that drew questions about partisanship at the court.
Well, if you remember, on Tuesday night, December 12, 2000, at about 10 p.m., the Supreme Court released its decision. And what we had was the sad spectacle of reporters standing on national TV trying to report the decision at the same time they were reading the decision. The Supreme Court could have done so much better than that. Nothing else, the Supreme Court, in its opinions, can give a short summary of exactly what it held, and they didn't do that here or in any case.
That was repeated with the health care ruling where I think CNN and Fox got it exactly wrong as they were trying to do what you were saying, read it and report on it at the same time.
Yes, and again, it was sad to see, you know, major networks literally state the holding of the case wrong. And I think a lot of the blame of that goes to the court. They could include in every decision a short, plain English statement of what they've decided, and that would help everybody understand. Also, of course, the reporters in those instances should have read the opinion before they announced what it said.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Jim on the line in Franklin. Jim, hi.
I'd like to ask your guest a question about the fact that we've capped the number of United States representatives at 435, I think. Why is the Supreme Court capped at 9? And would a larger Supreme Court be less political and more objective?
The reason it's 9 is historical accident. When the country began, it was divided into 5 regions, and each Supreme Court justice was given responsibility for a region. and it was actually called a circuit, and the justices were said to go and ride circuit. And as the country expanded, there was then a sixth circuit added, and sixth justice, then a seventh, and then an eighth, then a ninth, and then a tenth. And there were 10 Supreme Court justices in the 1860s. Hard for us to imagine now that there could have been an even number of Supreme Court justices during much of that part of American history. Andrew Johnson, as you know, was a terribly unpopular president, and Congress wanted to make sure that he couldn't pick anyone for the Supreme Court. So Congress said as soon as there was another vacancy, it would not be a seat on the court. They were going to reduce the number to 9. And it's been 9 ever since that time in the 1860s. Now we've come to just accept it's 9, but it's not in the Constitution. It's in a statute. It could be changed. Would more justices decrease the politics of it? My guess is if that's all we did, it wouldn't make any difference, because if we had 11 rather than 9, we'd have 6-5 rulings. If we had 13, it would be 7-6 rulings, and so on. I think there are things we can do. One thing that I propose is 18-year non-renewable terms, so there'd be a vacancy every 2 years, and every president would get the same ability to affect the court. Now, whether a president gets to make appointments, it's just an accident of history. Richard Nixon got 4 in 2 years. Jimmy Carter got none.
And that would also steer clear of these weird, is this elderly justice going to try to hang on for a president they agree with or leave during a Senate that would, you know, appoint or allow a successor that matches their ideology?
Exactly. I think it would be much better to say 18 years, a vacancy every 2 years. Every president gets the same ability to pick justices. And I think that over time could have a beneficial effect in terms of the politicization of the court.
Jim, thanks for the call. Now to Carla with us in Madison. Carla, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if the original intent of the founders was to have the three branches of government have equal strength, or was the Supreme Court intended to have less strength than the other branches?
It's so hard to know what the framers intended, and it's so hard to know what's meant by equal, more, less. Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers said that the Supreme Court's the least dangerous branch because it is neither the purse nor the sword. Excuse me. And in that sense, the Supreme Court is less powerful. On the other hand, having the last word is enormously powerful. And when it comes to issues like whether the Affordable Care Act is going to go into effect or whether gays and lesbians can marry, it's the Supreme Court that gets the last word. That, to me, makes them very powerful.
Carla, thanks for the call. Mark joins us now in Bayside. Mark, hi.
Hi. Very interesting discussion. I guess my biggest concern is as long as the Supreme Court seems to have the right to pick and choose the cases on which they choose to weigh in, and I don't have any kind of a solid understanding of how they make those decisions, it seems like the strongest weapon they have is when they simply refuse to hear a case. I'm wondering if you could shed some light on the criteria they use and whether or not they're consistent, or is it kind of happenstance as it appears to me?
In 1988, Congress changed the law to basically say it's entirely up to the justices to what cases they will hear. There's only one small exception where there are a couple of small exceptions where they're obligated to hear cases. Like if one state sues another state, the Supreme Court has to hear the case. But apart from those small exceptions, everything is up to the justices. If 4 justices vote to hear the case, they do. If 4 justices don't want to hear, if there aren't 4 justices to hear the case, they don't. It's up to them. They use some criteria. If a lower court declares a federal law unconstitutional, the Supreme Court almost always take the case. If it's an issue where the federal courts of appeals are split, divided, they're more likely to take the case. But it's really just up to, are there 4 votes to hear it?
As we start to wrap up, Erwin, you've called for a lot of changes in the Supreme Court. You've shared some of your ideas here, but is there any appetite from the people who'd have to make that decision? I mean, that a lot of this would be constitutional amendment, I imagine. Some wouldn't. Is anybody actually going to pursue this kind of far-reaching change?
I think there is appetite. Senator Leahy has introduced a bill that would apply the ethics standards for lower federal courts to the Supreme Court justices. Senator Leahy has introduced a bill for cameras in the court. Any president could create a merit selection system. My hope is the Senate on its own would change the confirmation process. As for term limits, that's the only reform I propose that I think would require a constitutional amendment. then Texas Governor Rick Perry, then presidential candidate in 2012, advocated non-renewable 18-year terms for Supreme Court justices. When you have someone who's liberal like me and someone like conservative like Rick Perry advocating the same thing, maybe it's really got a chance.
We'll leave it there. Erwin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Erwin Chemerinsky. He's founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Case Against the Supreme Court. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll catch up with the filmmaker Mark Borchert, who was the subject of the 1999 award-winning documentary American Movie.
First off, we take a look at what the Secret Service is up against after a very bad week for the agency. With the resignation of former director Julia Pearson over numerous security failures, the service has tapped former Presidential Protective Division Chief Joe Clancy to temporarily head that agency until a permanent director can be found.
One thing seems clear: whoever permanently takes over the position of Secret Service Director faces an uphill battle when it comes to restoring trust and restoring the service's image.
Joining us now to talk about the ongoing Secret Service story is Josh Gerstein. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. Josh, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be with you guys.
So, Josh, unusual bipartisan agreement on this one. It seems like everyone in Congress agrees that this last round of scandals at the Secret Service was a really big deal.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why we saw the Secret Service director forced out in a relatively short period of time. It became pretty clear that Julia Pearson didn't have the confidence of either the Democrats or the Republicans on Capitol Hill. And Republicans, who are often very critical of President Obama, really turned their fire on the Secret Service as an agency, didn't do much bashing of the president, and simply were flabbergasted at some of these mistakes and errors that have taken place in recent weeks.
A lot of stakeholders new leadership will have to win over, starting with the boss, President Obama. He can't be happy about the current performance. Even with a new director, how can the Secret Service earn the president's trust again?
Well, you know, they're going to bring in, as you said, this new director who had a prior relationship with President Obama, who was as head of the president's detail for several years at the beginning of the administration. So he's somebody who knows the president personally, who knows the president's top staff personally. So hopefully that would begin moving the process in the right direction. I think he's also going to have to commit to complete candor. One of the problems that has happened here is that it appears that the president and the top White House staff were not getting a full readout on all these problems. They were getting kind of grudging information when they asked for it instead of proactive disclosures. Apparently, people at the White House didn't know about this incident at the CDC in an elevator where you had a man who was armed, who had some kind of criminal past, who basically shouldn't have been in that elevator. The White House didn't learn about that until moments before it was reported publicly.
Yeah, I mean, the Secret Service, secrecy is half their name, but do they need to be more transparent to the president and the public?
I think they definitely do need to be more transparent. They've had a tradition, for example, of doing their own internal investigations. They have a professional responsibility office. A lot of other government agencies answer to an inspector general, who's someone who's presidentially appointed, has no connection whatsoever, usually, to the agency that they are inspecting, and can issue reports directly to Congress. The Secret Service, at least since the Department of Homeland Security took them over a decade or so ago, has never been subject to a true inspector general, has always done their own internal reports. It's kind of a strange carve-out, and I think it leads to just less transparency both to Congress, the public, and perhaps to the White House. I think we're going to see that process, that special carve-out for the Secret Service, come to an end.
Is there talk of doing that already, some kind of outside inspection?
Well, we're already looking at a top-to-bottom inspection. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson is going to appoint a group of wise men and women to look at these recent incidents and then the recent pattern of potential problems at the Secret Service and make recommendations. But I would be shocked if legislation that comes off Capitol Hill doesn't alter the process for internal reviews at the Secret Service. And then, of course, the big question is, if Mr. Clancy doesn't become the permanent director, would the president perhaps install someone from another law enforcement agency instead of the Secret Service, breaking the tradition of promoting from within there at that agency?
And you mentioned Capitol Hill, Congress not happy with the Secret Service, obviously. How does a new director, new management go about winning back congressional support and trust?
Well, this could be one of the trickiest things because these directors, at least the ones promoted from inside the agency, don't tend to be particularly savvy at politics and understanding how things work on Capitol Hill. So this might be another area where someone who's had to deal with politics in another realm might actually be able to manage the personalities and so forth on Capitol Hill a little bit better. It'd probably be someone good to have someone who can handle a congressional hearing or inquiry better than Director Pearson did the other day. She just seemed very defensive, and while her language may have said that they were determined to get to the bottom of it, her body language spoke otherwise, as if she was not very comfortable having to represent the agency at that hearing. I think they're going to need to have someone who's more of a public personality who can do both the congressional appearances and maybe even appear in the media to talk about what the Secret Service's responsibilities are.
Now, here's maybe a big deal. There's been talk that maybe potential assassins or White House intruders have been deterred by an aura of invulnerability from the Secret Service. Does this open the door to imitators, to, I don't know, terrorists even, to say, hey, they're not as tough as we thought they were?
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, one agent I spoke to said that the White House is already a magnet for people suffering from all kinds of mental illnesses and psychological confusion. So now you're going to have more discussion in the media leading to possible copycats. I'm less concerned that a person like that is going to actually make it into the White House or to the president under the current circumstances, and more concerned that there's going to be some use of force, perhaps deadly force, to stop them when that might not have been necessary in the past. And then you also have to wonder if terrorists or other people that want to do the president harm of a more serious mindset, maybe looking at some of these recent breaches and getting the idea that maybe the Secret Service isn't all it's been cut out to be. And they might attempt something, again, that, you know, may well not be successful, but could still cause a lot of damage, injury, and bloodshed. And so that's one of the greatest concerns here, that, you know, the Secret Service is not flawless, but they benefit from the perception that they're very, very good at what they do.
Josh, a story to follow. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, anytime. Take care.
That's Josh Gerstein. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. He joined us to discuss the challenges facing the new leadership at the Secret Service.
Coming up next, we meet a Wisconsin legend, filmmaker Mark Borchert, made famous in the documentary American Movie.
For this week's Wisconsin Legends segment, we turn the lens on Wisconsin independent filmmaker Mark Borchert. He was featured in the 1999 documentary American Movie, which followed Mark and his eccentric crew of family and friends through the struggles of making the movie Coven, a low-budget independent horror film.
That year, the documentary won the Sundance Film Festival's Grand Jury Prize, and in the years since has developed a cult-like following, due in part to Mark's passionate approach to life and filmmaking.
American Movie garnered Mark international attention, including appearances on David Letterman and Family Guy, and cameos in several large-budget Hollywood films. We recently caught up with the Milwaukee native and talked to him about his love for cinema and what he's been up to since that documentary. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So when did you first know that you wanted to devote your life to making films?
Well, I wanted to devote my life to my life about 5 years old, when I'd look up at the stars at night in the city and think, wow, what a wondrous opportunity this all is. I began writing first. Film came at the age of 14. I never was one for movies. I thought them infantile and nothing to do with the life that was actually being lived. I'd look at film books, though, and study the dramatic black and white stills and you know, just really regale myself in their compositions. And that's what excited me about film. I guess my imagination was on, you know, full speed ahead looking at those publicity stills and so forth. Mm. And, you know, you begin to wonder what the films were about and so forth. So I came to film a different way. Like I said, I wasn't really into quote-unquote movies. I was into film from the get-go.
And I didn't know this until just today, you did some radio dramas, Halloween radio dramas in Milwaukee. What were those like?
Sure. Actually, I was just thinking about that because, you know, someone said, hey, you know, you're on the air. I've been in front of a mic since like 94 when we I did 3 years of radio dramas, wrote, produced, and directed them, you know, and it was a full professional mix. And I've always listened to Suspense and Inner Sanctum and Lights Out and Escape and The Mysterious Traveler, et cetera, which should ring a bell with you guys.
Yeah.
as I listen to year after year after year as well of WHAD 8 to 11 on Sunday nights for old time radio drama. But I will say I started listening to radio dramas over 30 years ago, though.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the making of your film, Coven. It was captured in the documentary American Movie. You got international attention from that and a cult following. Can you tell us what you learned from that process and the aftermath and all that exposure that came afterwards?
Oh, you don't learn anything. You learn that one never changes. It's the people that are around them that change and their reactions and so forth. And there's the good-hearted aspect of it. There's a superficial aspect of all of that stuff. I never thought twice about it. It's not in my psyche. It's not in my bloodstream. When I made Coven, it was a great time. I shot it on 16mm black and white. And I knew what was going on when I was filming, and I'm very happy about the compositions with the scarecrows and all of that. With that, I got exactly what I wanted with the music, those opening credits. That's all I had hoped to accomplish aesthetically, and that is where I stand, you know. It was a cantankerous ordeal doing Coven. You know, you're dealing with lights, you're dealing with different crew members, you know, and you're a fluctuating schedule. And it was a 3-year effort, and it was really cool. It paid off and got it done.
Nowadays, a lot of filmmakers and others are using a crowdfunding, things like Kickstarter, to bring their works to reality. Have you looked into doing that? If you'd had it available back then, would you have used it for your previous projects?
Oh, I don't know about that. I'm just not interested in involving myself with a bunch of people. I have a singular personality. I've got my own agenda, my own continuing narrative. And the more people you encounter, the more potential that your singular narrative can be prone to being diluted. And I don't go for that. So, you know, who knows?
You know, another thing that's changed since you've made Coven is that people have talked a lot about the democratization of the movie-making process and that, you know, you don't have to be a Hollywood studio. There are still indie filmmakers, but they have so many more options now. There are smaller handheld cameras. There's the internet and YouTube. Do you think it's easier now to make it as a filmmaker than it used to be?
It's absolutely easier to make it as a filmmaker on a couple counts, technically, of course, because there's no longer a cost for film stock or anything like that. I mean, it's anyone can actually do it, and many do. And now also filmmaking has come into the popular culture. You're no longer you feel a sense of ostracization saying you're a filmmaker. That's just part of the culture now. I mean, you know, 10, 20 years from now, a writer, you know, if you're a novelist, it'll be like a filmmaker as literature seeps more and more into the populist psyche as film has done.
You've obviously got a lot of passion about filmmaking. It's almost contagious, and your story has inspired other people to make their own films. What advice would you have for somebody thinking, I think I have a film in me, I don't know how to start, I don't know what to do?
This is pretty platitudinous, but you have to be original, because if you are copying some other paradigm, you know, some other genre, and it's apparent that you're copying it, you're dead in the water. But if you have an original voice and it's really from the heart and you put genuine effort into it, that's the best advice one can give, along with taking it very seriously, being as prepared as you can and courteous and respectful to those, you know, that you find yourself, your colleagues that you're working with.
I want to ask a little bit about you, if you don't mind, because through your appearances on Letterman, other exposure in the media, people got really curious about you as a person. And I wonder now, you know, years down the road after some of that has died down, what is your day-to-day life like? Do you still roll out of bed and the first thing on your mind is making film? Is that your 9-to-5 job?
No, it never has been. And I've never thought about media appearances ever. I've never talked about it. I've never thought about it. You know, again, I'm thankful for whatever, you know, may happen. I'm thankful for the parking spot I got getting here. Your lot was packed. But, you know, I had patience. I came early and someone had pulled out and there's that one space. And, you know, with the preparation and contingency time, you know, it was we got here on time.
So you're not a superstar, you know, anymore, at least.
I was a superstar to myself since 1966. I don't, like I said, I don't get into any of this media stuff. Never have, never will. You never thought twice about it. I mean, as in for any, you know, a media attraction, that literally never ends. That never had its heyday. I mean, that continues, especially with the electronic universe. You open yourself up to it, and it's like a floodgate. There's no end. There's no peak. There's no valley. It just rolls on. If you so choose to get involved with that sort of lifestyle and thinking, that never ends.
And filmmaking, is it still your number one passion? It's still what you do from 9 to 5. What's on your mind most of the day?
Oh, I don't do anything from 9 to 5. I'm 24 hours of who I am. I write every day. That's number one. Filmmaking to me is a spiritual thing. I don't have anything to do with independent filmmaking. It's a personal agenda and so on and so forth. So it's completely maybe different in my aspect.
You've been an actor in other people's projects. I could see it going either way. Like it would be way easier because all the logistics and everything else, they're on that other person. I could see it being harder too, like because you know kind of what they need from you. How does acting compare to making a film?
Acting compared to making a film is entirely different. There are actually many, many professional actors. I mean, at the height of the craft, you have De Niro and so on and so forth. This is what they do. Pacino, Strasburg, all of that. That this is their lives. This is their craft. This is what they believe in. Other people, they merely show up in front of the frame and exude their personality. So it's a different level of acting. It's just an amplified sense of self. So obviously, you have to be responsible. You learn your lines. You know, you learn them. You know, you study them the day before. It's like a military operation, day to day to day to day of studying, acting, studying, acting, studying, acting. And, you know, if you're responsible, you know your lines, you're able to perform and all as well.
Now, you said earlier on that the films that you were seeing were not reflective of real life. So I'm curious, today, 2014, are you seeing movies right now that you loved? Have you seen one that you love?
Oh no! The concept of movies, the concept, the overall concept is a populist entertainment, which I never had any interest in whatsoever. No, I've always been immersed, like in Antonioni and Bergman and Tarkovsky and Wells and Polanski, Dreyer, et cetera, on and on and on. I've never kowtowed to any populist bent or wasted a great amount of time with any of that other stuff.
Have you seen anything that you loved lately?
Let's see. In the mid-80s was Jim Jarmusch's Down by Law. In around mid-90s was Slam, Mark Levin's Slam. In the after the turn of the century and into the teens was Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. Now that's for films that I encountered at the time that they came out, you know. So those, each decade, that 80s was Down by Law, 90s Slam, present, Tree of Life. But again, those are not my references. My reference are Bergman's Hour of the Wolf, Scenes from a Marriage, Persona, Shame, Face to Face, Autumn Sonata, you know, Antonioni's Mysteries, Dreyer's Passion of Joan of Arc, Vampyr, Day of Wrath, Odette, Gertrude, all of that. I mean, it just on and on and on. I mean, I don't reference. I have no dealings with. I don't receive things, you know, ambiguously. I do my research and then move forward from that.
Well, what is next on the filmmaking horizon for you? Do you have a project in the works or in mind?
I've got a whole stack of things I got to send out for registration and copyright, various written projects and so on and so forth. So film-wise, yeah, that's interesting. I I shot 4 different projects, but I don't sit in front of screens. So I don't edit. You know, I don't. Life's too short to be looking at a screen. So, you know, I'm really into the process. Had a really great time shooting dozens of hours of footage. And someday I may assemble it. And as for any upcoming film projects, if it strikes me, absolutely. Again, you know, I like to think, I like to read, I like to write. Those have always been my main agenda. And filmmaking was a way to show the outside world, or, you know, amplify those interests to the point where other people could experience them. So I will say, though, I'm in Frankie Latina's new film, Snapshot. And Frankie Latina is just an outstanding filmmaker here in Milwaukee who did Modus Operandi on Super 8. And now he, again, got Danny Trejo to town and Cade Carradine to star in his new masterpiece shot on Super 16, Snapshot.
Well, Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you. No, it was wonderful. What a delight.
That was Mark Borchert, writer, filmmaker, and Milwaukee native.